This is Understanding Israel-Palestine. I'm Margot Patterson, the producer of this week's episode.
We'll be hearing about the results of the November elections in Israel and how and why the right became so dominant in Israeli politics. But first, news.
Leading Israeli human rights organizations and activists have urged the United States to add far-right lawmakers Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich to its U.S. sanctions list for encouraging human rights violations and inciting terror. The letter, addressed to U.S. Ambassador to Israel Thomas Nides, was sent in mid-November as Prime Minister-in-Waiting Benjamin Netanyahu was finalizing his far-right governing coalition, which is likely to give the two men senior ministerial positions in it. More than 200 activists and human rights groups signed the letter. It cites Ben-Gvir's role in the incitement leading up to the 1995 assassination of Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin and his role in the Kach movement, designated at one time by the U.S. as a terrorist organization. It says that Smotrich has advocated for population transfer and publicly incited genocide against the Palestinian people. The activists also urge action against Ben Zion Gopstein, a senior advisor to Ben-Gvir, who was barred from running for parliament in 2019 because of his extremism. Gopstein heads an organization aimed at preventing Arab assimilation, whose activists have vandalized bilingual schools and marched in the streets while assaulting non-Jewish passersby. Prominent figures in British theater and film are protesting the cancellation of a Lifetime Achievement Award to British playwright Carol Churchill because of her support for Palestinian rights. Churchill, one of the United Kingdom's most influential dramatists, has written more than 30 plays. In April, she was named the recipient of the 2022 European Drama Award in honor of her life's work. The 75,000 euro prize was awarded by the German theater company Schauspiel Stuttgart and sponsored by the Baden-Württemberg Ministry of Science, Research and Arts. The jury appointed by the theater company rescinded the prize in November after they learned Churchill supports the Boycott Divestment Sanctions Movement known as BDS, which seeks to pressure Israel to end its occupation. Critics of the cancellation have issued an open letter stating, "This attack on freedom of conscience is nothing less than modern-day McCarthyism and raises urgent questions about a pattern of intimidation and silencing." The news outlet Axios has reported that the White House and the State Department told Israel that they were not behind the FBI's decision to open an investigation of the killing of Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. The well-known reporter for Al Jazeera was wearing a bulletproof vest marked Press when she was killed in May while covering an Israeli raid in the occupied West Bank. Her family and the Palestinian Authority have accused Israel of deliberately targeting her. While the Biden administration has been pressed by Democrats in Congress to have the FBI investigate her killing, the White House and the State Department made it clear to Israel that they had not been involved in the Department of Justice's decision-making process. Though Israel has vehemently protested the investigation and announced it will not cooperate with it, Israeli officials told Axios that they expect the FBI investigation to be symbolic without any practical consequences. My guest today is Dov Waxman. He is a professor of political science and the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation Chair of Israel Studies at UCLA. His research focuses on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, Israeli politics and foreign policy, U.S.-Israel relations, American Jewry's relationship with Israel. He is the author of four books. His most recent is The Israeli-Palestinian Conflict, What Everyone Needs to Know. Dov Waxman, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
There's been a slew of inconclusive Israeli elections in recent years, but the election November 1st resulted in a clear win for former Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Despite facing corruption charges, he's set to take power again in an alliance with ultra-nationalist and religious Zionist parties. What does this far-right government mean for Israel and for Israeli democracy? What does it mean for the Palestinians?
So what does it mean for Israeli democracy? I think a lot's going to depend upon what the next government's going to look like, what policies it's going to adopt. It looks at the moment like Netanyahu's going to form a narrow right-wing government, a government with just three other parties in addition to his own Likud party. Two of those parties are ultra-Orthodox parties. One is a merger of three small far-right parties. If Netanyahu does assemble this governing coalition, it will be the most right-wing and most religious government in Israel's history. I think it doesn't bode well, to put it mildly, for Israeli democracy, for Jewish-Arab relations inside Israel, or for Israeli-Palestinian relations. One of the key goals of this new coalition, if it comes into being, is going to be what they call judicial reform, which is really a way of saying that basically they want to reduce the independence and power of the judiciary in Israel, and particularly the Supreme Court, which on the right has long been regarded as a kind of bastion of liberalism, of left-wingers, even though that's actually not entirely an accurate perception. But there is a long-standing desire by the political right in Israel to reduce the power of the Supreme Court so that essentially the Knesset can do what it likes, the Israeli parliament.
What impact, if any, do you think this new right-wing government will have on U.S.-Israel relations?
I think it's going to have a negative impact. I think Prime Minister Netanyahu himself has a tense relationship, if you like, with members of the Democratic Party in the United States. There's a lot of Democrats who remember, and not fondly, Netanyahu's intervention back in 2015 when the Iran nuclear deal was being discussed and debated. He went to Congress without being invited at the time by then President Obama. He was seen then and is still seen now as really aligned with the Republican Party. So I think certainly Democrats aren't going to be happy with this new government and going to be aren't going to be happy with Netanyahu back in power or with some of the people he's considering appointing to senior ministries in Israel. I think President Biden himself, though, will want to avoid the kinds of public disputes that took place between Netanyahu and President Obama. President Biden has got a lot on his agenda, and I think the last thing he wants is a headache with Netanyahu. So I think at least in their relationship, things will at least publicly remain fairly cordial. But I think there's a lot of concern right now behind the scenes in Washington with what this government's going to look like, particularly with the possibility that some of these far-right extremists are going to have major positions in the Israeli government. Even possibly one of them might become the defense minister, which works with the United States a lot. So there's concerns about that, and there's concerns about the kinds of policies that they're going to implement.
Some people have been using the word fascist to describe some of the parties in the new governing alliance. Is that a fair and accurate description?
Yeah, I think it's accurate for at least one of the members, one of the leaders, perhaps if not both of the leaders of this merged party called Religious Zionism, which actually now might be about to break up. But this party, which is a far-right party, one of the leaders of this party, Itamar Ben-Gvir, is really, you know, I think very much akin to either a kind of European fascist or an American white supremacist. Essentially, he has very little regard for the rights of minorities. He believes that Jews have all the rights, or should have all the rights in Israel, that they are, in his words, the kind of landlords of the country. They get to decide what Israel's government should do. And he's even talked about expelling disloyal Jewish and Arab citizens of Israel. I think that certainly evokes fascism.
And what kind of new policies do you think the government will set?
First and foremost, as I said, it will be in trying to basically restrain or muzzle the judiciary, particularly the Supreme Court, and to pass a law that will allow the Israeli parliament, the Knesset, to override any rulings by the Supreme Court that veto legislation passed by the government, essentially ending the practice of judicial review. So I think that's going to be a primary area where they're going to focus on the judiciary. They're also going to roll back the few reforms that took place under the previous government with regards to the relationship between religion and state, particularly basically allowing the ultra-Orthodox who weren't in the last government to really re-establish their monopoly over religious affairs in Israel, at least for its Jewish citizens. And I think with regards to the Palestinians, you're going to see, first of all, an expansion and acceleration of settlement construction in the West Bank. You're going to see the authorization or the legalization of so-called illegal outposts. These were settlements that were not officially authorized by the Israeli government. They're deemed illegal under Israeli law. Those settlements will be retroactively legalized. And I think the government could also potentially change the policies that govern the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, what Jews refer to as the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, which has been a real epicenter of tension and of violence in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So I think with regards to the Palestinians, you know, this government could really inflame matters.
There was an article in the Middle East Eye, November 16th, by Israeli historian Ilan Pape, and the subtitle was, "The Far-Right Coalition Will Continue to Oppress Palestinians, but with more disregard for global censure than ever before." Do you agree with that? And how will that affect the normalization that's been going on between Arab countries and Israel?
That's a good question. There are certainly parts of this coalition, if it comes into being, it hadn't yet been finalized, it could still fall apart. So I don't want to kind of assume that this narrow right-wing government will come into being, but I think it is the most likely outcome. If that happens, certainly there are those, particularly on the far right of the coalition, who really couldn't care less what the United States or the international community think. So I think that is true, but Netanyahu himself is a more cautious politician. He does care about what the United States thinks. He's not going to want to have major conflicts with the United States, or for that matter with the EU, which is Israel's major trading partner. And I think Netanyahu also wants to preserve these normalization agreements, these diplomatic agreements that Israel signed under his watch when he was prime minister, the so-called Abraham Accords that Israel reached with Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates and Morocco in particular. It's possible that if this government were to really escalate the situation in the West Bank and accelerate construction of settlements and the situation between Israel and the Palestinians really deteriorated, that could affect those relationships with Israel, between Israel and its new Arab allies. So I think there will be some breaks, if you like, on what the next government could do. But I agree that I think there is less today that's going to restrain this government than there was in the past. And we should also bear in mind that the international community is really focused elsewhere. Ukraine, obviously, is a major focus. So I think there's just generally going to be less attention given to what Israel is doing in the West Bank than maybe in years past.
The Labour Party only won about 3.5% of the vote in the November 1st election. The Meretz Party didn't even pass the threshold to be in the parliament. The Israeli left has shrunk. The right has grown consistently over the course of the last 20 years. What accounts for the decline of the left? And more particularly, what accounts for the steady growth of the right?
So I think there are a couple of factors that really account for the decline of the Israeli left, or the Zionist left in particular, that is the Labour Party and its ally on the left, the Meretz Party. It's important to recognize that this decline wasn't just the result of one election. These two parties and the Zionist left in general has really been gradually declining for three decades now, since the early 90s, when it was at the high point of its power, when it came into power back in 1992 under Yitzhak Rabin. Since then, there's really been this kind of slow and steady decline of its appeal to Israelis. And I think there's two reasons. First of all, the failure of the peace process. The left's defining issue has long been reaching a two-state solution with the Palestinians, achieving peace with the Palestinians. That's proven to be, to put it mildly, difficult. Many Israeli Jews have really given up hope on the ability to achieve a two-state solution with the Palestinians. The peace process is considered a failure. So the kind of signature issue of the left, the possibility for peace and the two-state solution, has really lost its appeal to Israelis. They don't believe that's possible. And the left hasn't really been able to reinvent itself or come up with another agenda that can really capture the attention of Israelis. So I think that's one big factor. But it's not just a question of the failure of the peace process. It's also, I think, the decline of the left is due to kind of demographic changes in Israel. The people who vote typically for the left-wing parties, the Jewish voters, are mostly Ashkenazi Jews, Jews who originally came from Europe, and the vast majority of them are secular. And many tend to be more highly educated and more affluent, whereas the fastest growing segments of Israel's population are more religious Jews, particularly ultra-Orthodox Jews. So the long-term trends, the long-term demographic trends in Israel basically point to a growth of the religious population, particularly the ultra-Orthodox population. And that favors the right because they religious voters in Israel typically vote for right-wing parties and much more identified with the right than with the left. Over time, as this demographic shift takes place, this is strengthening the right. And this, again, isn't just the result of, we don't see this just in this most recent election. In fact, in all the Israeli elections but one over the more than two decades now, right-wing parties have won a clear majority in the parliament. And most Israeli Jews today identify as on the right. One recent survey said, showed that 64% of Jewish Israelis identify as the on the right. And so I think it indicates that really the right has become politically dominant in Israel and that it's going to remain so for some time to come, I think.
If you're just tuning in, this is Understanding Israel-Palestine. I'm Margot Patterson, and I'm talking to Dov Waxman, Director of the Center for Israel Studies at UCLA. I want to ask you more about what you just said. It's my perception that for the last 20 years or so, Israel has kind of been in the catbird seat. It hasn't experienced much terrorism. The Palestine papers that Al Jazeera released some years ago show Palestinian peace negotiators willing to bend over backwards to give Israel anything and everything it might want if a peace agreement can be reached. Given that, why this growth in the right?
Support for a two-state solution, support for a government committed to pursuing a two, has really collapsed. It's not to say that most Israeli Jews in an ideal world wouldn't want a two-state solution. I think they probably would, but there's really no belief that it's possible any longer. And most Israeli Jews have reached the conclusion, I think it's not the correct conclusion, but their conclusion is that the Palestinians aren't interested in a two-state solution. And therefore the right, which has always maintained that and is opposed to Palestinian state from the outset, has been able to garner more support among Israeli Jews. I think the other factor beyond other than the Palestinian issue is this perception that the right are loyal to Israel's Jewish character. They're perceived as the best protectors of Israel's Jewish character and Israel's Jewish identity. And as many Israeli Jews are more traditional and more religious, they therefore are more likely to gravitate to right-wing parties.
One of your books focuses on the debate within the American Jewish community over Israel. What was the status of that debate going into the election, and how do you think this new government is likely to affect it?
There's a long-standing divide within the American Jewish community when it comes to Israel and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in particular. There's a debate, you know, just as there is in Israel, between Jews on the right and Jews on the left over whether Israel should be willing to withdraw from the West Bank, end the occupation, whether it's even considered an occupation, whether the Palestinians can be trusted as partners for a peace process. You know, these are all longstanding issues of debate among American Jews. I should say, though, that although there's a very vocal and visible group of American Jews on the right, they don't represent anything close to the majority of opinion within the American Jewish community. Most American Jews are liberal, support a two-state solution. Nowadays, they support a two-state solution more than Israeli Jews support a two-state solution. They want the United States to be actively involved in trying to bring one about. They even favor American pressure on Israel as well as on the Palestinians to reach a solution to the conflict, and they oppose Israeli settlement building in the West Bank. So, you know, there is a consensus in many ways among many American Jews about what Israel should be doing. And many of them who are liberal and more secular are very alarmed by the incoming Israeli government. You know, Netanyahu is not particularly popular within large parts of the American Jewish community. And his far-right coalition partners, this Religious Zionist Party, is really regarded as a racist, fascist party. And so there is a lot of concern among American Jews today about what this new government might do. And I think a broader sense that the Israel that they see today is not the Israel that they knew and loved, that they saw in Israel a different country than the country it's becoming, which is more right-wing and more religious than many American Jews would like.
You made a reference recently to New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman's article after the Israeli election, "The Israel We Knew Is Gone." Friedman wrote, "The new Israeli government is a nightmare coalition with the further disadvantage being real." He described, and I'm quoting now, "a rowdy alliance of ultra-Orthodox leaders and ultra-nationalist politicians, including some outright racist, anti-Arab Jewish extremists, once deemed completely outside the norms and boundaries of Israeli politics," close quote. And you noted that Friedman's lament over an Israel he now thinks gone is late, that Israel has basically been gone for at least a decade. Was there one signal event that changed, in your opinion, or was it a succession of events and policies? And do you think the media in this country has been accurately reporting that reality, or is it that people have just not been paying attention?
This change in Israeli politics and in the nature of Israeli society has been a gradual one. It's been happening for decades, as I said, partly really going back to the mid-1990s as the Oslo peace process started and stalled and then ultimately collapsed. You see this gradual right-wing shift in Israeli public opinion. You see, as a result of the demographic growth of the religious, that they ultra-Orthodox having growing influence and power in Israeli politics and society. So there's been a long-term shift in Israel that's really gained momentum in recent years, particularly under Netanyahu, because Netanyahu has done a lot to really empower the far right in Israel for his own reasons. So I think the rise today of the far right is a new development in the sense that it's achieved its best electoral result in Israel's history in the most recent election. It's now, you know, the third largest party in parliament. So that is a new development. But I think there's been for some time now a growth of this kind of far right populism in Israeli politics. I think there's been quite a lot of attention paid to it. But obviously, you know, Americans have been more focused, understandably, on what's happening in the United States than what's happening in Israel. I think it can be quite hard for Americans to understand the complexities of Israeli politics. It's a very different political system there. To understand Israeli society is quite difficult. It's kind of much more tribal in many ways. And I think there is still a kind of nostalgia, a perception of Israel of being more secular, more liberal than it actually is. This election result will certainly challenge that perception and undermine that perception, as Friedman's column suggests it is doing.
Since it acquired the West Bank in 1967, Israel has been steadily colonizing it with Jewish settlers. I recently finished reading Jimmy Carter's White House diaries, and he talks about how reluctant Prime Minister Begin was to give up the West Bank back then. Is a two-state solution still viable today?
Well, that's a big question, and it would require a very long answer. The short answer is I don't think so. I think it's technically possible. I mean, insofar as even with the growth over decades of Israeli settlements in the West Bank and the growth of the Jewish population living in the West Bank, now about maybe 500,000 Jews now living in the West Bank. Many of the largest settlements and the largest number of settlers live in settlements located pretty close to the June 1967 de facto border between Israel and the West Bank, known as the Green Line. So it's possible to draw a border between a future Palestinian state and Israel. It's possible to evacuate those settlers who would live on the who would be on the wrong side of that border to move them back to Israel. Israel did in the past, of course, withdraw from the Gaza Strip. It's possible. It's technically it could be done with enough political will. Obviously, if there was an Israeli-Palestinian peace agreement, but I think it's going to be very, very, very unlikely. First of all, because I think the prospects for reaching an Israeli-Palestinian peace agreement are practically nil. The two parties have repeatedly tried to negotiate an agreement and have failed to reach a compromise. They've moved closer to each other's positions. There's been progress, but they haven't been able to narrow the gaps on the major issues that divide them. So I think a peace agreement is going to be hard to achieve in the first place. And it's going to be very, very difficult for any Israeli government to withdraw something like 100,000 or more Jewish settlers who are going to end up in the territory that would be allotted to a Palestinian state. I don't think any Israeli government's going to want to do that. Not to mention on the Palestinian side, you have this long-standing division between Hamas and Fatah, Hamas, which controls the Gaza Strip. Fatah's nominally in power in the West Bank. So that long-standing division means that I think the Palestinians are also not really in a position today to reach a peace agreement with Israel. So it's possible technically, but I think practically speaking, it's no longer feasible.
In that article in the Middle East Eye by Israeli historian Ilan Pape, he says, quote, "The disappearance in this election of the Zionist left can also be easily understood if one appreciates the depth and breadth of racism within Israeli society, particularly among youth," close quote. Could you talk about that racism, if you think that's the right word, and why it's become imbued in Israeli youth? We usually think of young people as being less bigoted, not more. What accounts for it?
Well, I do think there is definitely racism within Israeli Jewish society when it comes to perceptions of Arabs, Arab citizens of Israel, and Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. Part of this, of course, should be understood as a consequence of a century, more than a century, of violence and a conflict between Jews and Palestinian Arabs. This began even before Israel was established. So when you have a long-running ethnic conflict, you're going to have dehumanization that's going to take place. You're going to have racism that's going to occur on both sides. The tendency to demonize the other, to see the other as somehow less than fully human or as not deserving of equal rights. So part of it, I think, is this kind of long-term forcing of social attitudes on both sides and within Israeli Jewish society, this a kind of consequence of years and years of perceiving Arabs as the enemy, essentially. But I think for young Israeli Jews in particular, it's exacerbated by the fact that they have grown up after the peace process, right? They really have come of age during the Second Intifada and during Israel's numerous wars with Hamas and other Palestinian militant groups in Gaza. So they really have, as children in many cases, experienced terrorism during the Second Intifada. They've grown up with that fear of terrorism. They've grown up with the fear of rocket attacks. So I think part of it comes from that. And part of it is a response to the fact that they have almost no interaction with Arabs or Palestinians. The Israeli school system is separated. So Jews attend different schools than Arab citizens of Israel. And Israeli Jews, unless they're in the army or they're settlers, hardly ever encounter Palestinians living in the West Bank. So when you have such separation between two populations, that I think in and of itself, that lack of contact breeds suspicion and distrust. And then on top of that, we have to remember that young Israeli Jews, as I mentioned before, are also more likely to be religious. Israel has a young population, and the fastest growing segments of that population are the religious. So many of them are young religious Jews who also really haven't been exposed to the values of liberalism or of tolerance. That's not part of their schooling. On the contrary, what they're taught sometimes is basically to fear and distrust Arabs.
That was Professor Dov Waxman, Director of the Center for Israel Studies at the University of California, Los Angeles. Dov Waxman, thank you so much for talking to us today.
My pleasure.
You've been listening to Understanding Israel-Palestine. Join us again next week at this time for another episode.